many alcoholic men and women in this room tonight and listening later on NavaClub.org desperately in need will hear our speaker tonight, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. Tonight, we finally have Greg J. in the house. He's a 545 Nava guy. Everybody that's heard him share has a pretty good idea that this is going to be one heck of a ride. So please welcome Greg.
Alrighty, I'm Greg, and I am a real alcoholic.
Hey, Greg.
Oh, man. They said I wouldn't be nervous, but I'm a nervous person anyway, so I knew I was going to be nervous. I wasn't worried about that aspect. But I guess my story is no different than anyone else's. You know, just sick as hell, want to get better. You know, my story just starts out like any other normal kid. I grew up in Gary, Indiana, a little town about 30 minutes from Chicago, just on the Indiana-Illinois border. I come from a very large family. I have 6 sisters and 3 brothers. To say we were poor would be stretching it. We were poor. But we were happy. I had a wonderful mother and father. I'm going to get that out of the way. My dad just passed here this past September. Hardcore man, my hero. I heard Charles Barkley say that once. He said, don't let athletes or entertainers or anyone of status be someone you idolize. Well, growing up, I didn't idolize my dad. Matter of fact, I despised him. He was a mill worker, steel mill worker, hardcore, old school, old from Alabama, right outside of Livingston. And he was hardcore, man. He ran the house with iron fists. And I mean iron fists. We would call it child abuse today, but my dad was an alcoholic, workaholic, and he was a womanizer. I said I had 6 sisters and 3 brothers, but in all, my dad had 16 children. So as we got older, growing up, over the years, got to meet some of my siblings that we didn't know about. They weren't raised with us. And like I say, coming from Gary, a steel mill town, hardcore, hardworking, blue collar, we moved from the east side to the west side. We weren't the Jackson anymore. We were the Jeffersons. I mean, that was the first time. We were moving on up. I mean, we left the east side of town, which was pretty much in the hood, to the west side was white suburban. And, God, first time I ever saw green grass. We had an orchard in the backyard. I mean, apple trees, cherries, plums, peaches, pears. And we thought we was in heaven, man. And in essence, we were. But in that time, that was the early 60s. My baby sister was born in 64, and that's the year we moved from the east to the west. And my parents had a great idea. By the time that second year rolled around, they wanted to ship me off to the suburbs, the real suburbs. For about fourth grade, I was going to a predominantly all-white school. I only had one other black person in my classroom. It was Patricia Cobb and I. Man, we were like ducks in the water, I tell you. But it was a great experience. While my parents chose me out of all of us to want to integrate at the time, it's beyond me. And it was just a great experience. I mean, it was everything you ever want for so far as growing up in a, I want to call it a culture shock, because that's what it was. But at the same time, it was very interesting, because I got to meet all these different groups of people that I didn't even believe in. I mean, from Irish, Polish, German, Italian, Jews, the whole nine. And they were from upper class. I mean, they had 3-car garages and swimming pools, and, you know, they ate strange foods. And me being a youngster, but I was very athletic. That was my outlet when I was real young. I was a jock, and I could play sports. I could run, jump, and I could hoop with the best of them. In Indiana, you know, basketball is heaven. I mean, that's like in the South is football. Up north is basketball. And I excelled in it. And that probably was the beginning of my downfall, because as I grew up, you know, living in one side of town, going to school in another, I was kind of living two different lifestyles. I got introduced to alcohol, the best of alcohol, not by my dad. My dad drank old corn liquor, because my granddaddy was a moonshiner in Alabama. That's how he raised most of his children, was through moonshine. And so I knew what moonshine was, but I didn't know what blackberry brandy was and Cavassier. Oh my God, what's that? You know, but so any alcohol that my friends drank, I drank. And Italians love to drink wine, and I had quite a few Italian friends, and they love wine. I also had quite a few Italian friends; they smoked a lot of marijuana. You know, so being respectful to the charter membership and singleness of purpose, my story entails a lot of drug use. Drinking and drugging was just a way of life. It's what you did, especially if you worked in the mills. I mean, you had to drink to work in steel mills. I mean, you worked around the clock, you know, days, 4 to 12, midnights. And it was probably pretty much established. If you didn't go to college or into the military, after high school, you was going to be a mill worker. It was just that simple. It was a good life. I mean, I say we were poor, but I don't mean poor in the sense that we never had food on the table. We always had food on the table. My friends and most of the guys I grew up with and the women I knew, they would come to our house. With all these kids in the house, they would still come to our house and be expecting a meal. My dad was just a steel worker. He was a great farmer, and he can grow collard greens out of this world. I mean, he can grow any vegetable out of the backyard along with that orchard. So between my mother canning fruits and my dad and this gorgeous garden, that I have to tell you, I hated that garden, man, because every year we had to turn that soil. We didn't have no tiller machine. It was just me and my brothers and my dad. And let me tell you about my brothers now. My brothers were lazy as hell. Anytime my dad would mention it's time to till the garden, he'd bring the shovels out. I had one brother would sneak out the back way. I had another brother would go down the alley. And my oldest brother, he just wasn't going to do nothing. He just, you know, he just refused to work for my dad, you know. And so it would be just me and my dad. We'd be out there turning the soil, and, you know, we'd be cultivating this ground. And it was a beautiful thing to watch, you know. Like I said, my dad was very uneducated. I mean, he probably had a sixth grade education. He brags to say he had an eighth grade education. Right. It was really sixth, you know, and he started working in them fields, picking cotton, you know, and I guess his dream was to get out of the South. And that's what his dream was. He moved to the North, and like most Southerners did, it was a migration. And it's weird, I'm going to fast forward, because it's just reversed now. Most of the Northerners is coming back to the South. And for opportunity, jobs, there's no jobs in the steel mill towns. Your refineries, any kind of blue collar industry is kind of dead right now. And everybody knows that. The economy sucks. But my story just consists of me trying my best to want to be an NBA ball player. That was my dream. That was my ambition in life. That was my way out of the hood, like most brothers, you know. And you know Gary Gannon, you also know that that's where the Jackson 5 are from. So, and my last name being Jackson, well, everywhere I went, that's the first question people ask, you know the Jackson 5. Right, yes, I did know the Jackson 5. They lived behind Roosevelt High School, and they played in the same ball field we played in. But they had a very strict dad. We thought our dad was crazy. Well, Joe was just a little bit crazy, because he had this dream of turning his boys into this phenomenal entertainment group. Really, what he wanted them to be was the Osmonds, the Black Osmonds. And he did. He transformed them. He stopped working in the mill. I think he said he took his last paycheck and went and bought all this equipment for his five sons. I mean, it really was six of them. And he drilled him like a drilling star. And, well, everybody knows the rest of the story. But the bottom line is, my family and my brothers, we always wonder, why can't we be the Jacksons, you know? But thank God. I thank God that he didn't drill that in us. But at the same time, he did drill into us the essence of hard work, taking care of yourself, and taking care of your family. And my mom was just a normal housewife. My mom didn't work. Yes, I take that back. She worked, you know, cooking and cleaning and looking after all these kids. Yeah, it was a lot of hard work. My mom was an entrepreneur. She started her own ceramic business out of a hobby. Next thing we knew, my dad burnt the garage down once. He really did it twice. So the second time he did it, my mom turned the garage and added onto the house, and she made her a ceramic studio. And I toiled in that ceramic studio for many a years. But again, so I learned the essence of hard work and entrepreneurship through my parents, two uneducated people. And out of all my siblings, seven of them went to college. They all went to Indiana University, and they all got degrees in various fields. I, for one, after my basketball career didn't all pan out, and I ran, man, I ran. I mean, I hated Gary. Like I said, growing up, it was, I would say, 65-35% white. And as I got older, it became blacker and blacker. Eventually, it became a black town. You wouldn't see a white person. I don't care where you were. And if you did see one, you probably was black. You know, he talked black, he walked like my girl Debbie did. He was just as cool as the other side of the pillow. And you see, that's funny. And even the Italians, even the Germans, even the Jews, even the Polish, I mean, you know, they just, what we call back then was white flight. You know, and that's basically what it was. And they just didn't take your homes. I mean, they took their businesses too. So our downtown, literally to this day, is a ghost town. I mean, it's dead. Yeah, all it needs is the tumbleweeds and some Clint Eastwood and music, and you swear you're in the good, the bad, and the ugly. And it will scare the hell out of you. But that's my hometown, and I wanted to get away from it. I mean, I thought basketball would be an out. It wasn't, so I went and joined the Navy. No, first I went and joined the Marines. But during that time, right after high school, once I finished high school, it took me an extra year to finish high school, and I graduated from high school in the hospital. At Gary Method Hospital, they brought me my diploma. I was suffering from what you call ulcerative colitis, and in layman's terms, it's just bleeding ulcers. I acquired bleeding ulcers at 17. It was just from the stress, not eating properly, and drinking a hell of a lot of liquor. And it was frightening, because my mother saw it first, and I didn't know it, but if you ever had a bloody stool, you'll know that something ain't right. And when they brought me my diploma, I just knew this is my house. This is my getaway. At least I've accomplished something. And so I did. I joined the Marines. About a week before basic training was over, my ulcerative colitis kicked in. If you don't know how painful bleeding internally feels, it's very painful. And they asked me that I wanted a discharge on an honorable through a medical. The sergeant major came into the hospital at Balboa in San Diego, and man, I felt like, wow, they're going to pay me to get out of the service? And I'm in San Diego? Hey, sounds like a winner. As always, I ended up in San Diego County Jail. It seemed like everywhere I went, man, throughout my story, throughout my life, if I didn't end up in some institution for my bipolar disorder or manic depression, I ended up in jail because of my alcoholism or my drug use or some other insidious thing. You know, sometimes it wasn't even a reason. I just would end up in jail. And my family would come bail me out. They'd come all the way from Deer, Indiana to San Diego, all the way to Sacramento, all the way to Knoxville, Tennessee, to Atlanta, you know, to New York, Buffalo. It seemed like wherever I would end up in jail or some institution. And then, about my mid-30s, you know, after running all over. And then I left out the part about the Navy. Because after I got off the Marines, you know, I did a little time in San Diego County Jail. They extradited me back to Gary. I turned around about 2 months later and joined the Navy. I figured it was easier. You know, it wasn't stressful. You know, the drill instructors didn't riot you all day and night, you know. But the Navy, the same thing happened. I mean, under the same circumstances, about 2 weeks before graduation boot camp, my ulcerative colitis kicked up there. And sure enough, I'm in San Diego again. So this time I'm not going to stay in San Diego. I'm going to catch the Greyhound to L.A. I got a sister living in Inglewood. You know, she's in the entertainment field. Well, this might be my big break. Man, the Jackson 5. Huh? And maybe I might be able to meet one of them. No. But really, the same thing happened. I ended up in L.A. County Jail. So, again, it was just a continuous what's it called? My sister would say, I have a very spiritual sister who's worked for the Cab County School Board, retired now. She's got her doctorate. She would say, you just went out of control, SOB. And we tired of you. But we love you. I say, really? Then why do you call DeKalb County on me every other month, you know? I was that insane. I ran from this addiction. I ran from my alcoholism. I literally ran from anything that was had a struggle involved. I didn't like work. You know? I wanted the easiest software. Work. So hustling and playing and trying to be hip, slick, and cool. Man, that was right in my alley. And I knew a bunch of pimps and players in the area in Chicago. But to this day, I would say probably 95% of them are dead. But they look so beat up, you know. Why would I want to be like that? But at the time, it sounded like a good idea. But, you know, my alcoholism and my drinking caused so much pain in my life, not physically or emotionally and mentally, but the strain it put on my family. Like I said, I have a wonderful, wonderful family. They're praying warriors. And I know I wouldn't be standing here if it wasn't for them. Getting introduced in this program, I was in Atlanta. After I got out of L.A. County Jail, my sister took me to a meeting up in Torrance, California. It's like up in the hills. And she dropped me off at an 8 o'clock meeting. And when she dropped me off, all I saw was Choppers. You know, big old shiny chrome bikes, you know. And sure enough, when I walked in, it was a bunch of guys at the Hell's Angel jacket on, big long beards. And I'm like, damn, she set me up again. What the hell is this, you know? And that was over 30-some years ago. I didn't know what recovery was. I didn't even know what AA was. I just knew it was a lot of guys in there talking the same stuff we were talking today. And they seemed to be at peace with themselves. Did I want that? Yeah. Did I want to go through the work to get there? Hell no. What I wanted was one of them damn choppers. That's not what I really wanted, but I didn't see too many brothers in the Hell's Angels, let me be honest with you. Maybe now, today, it might be different, but back then, no. And my story brought me back to Gary. After I had a son, I have a 26-year-old son who was born in Inglewood. Now, a beautiful young lady was from Buffalo, New York, and we lasted about a year. My girl Susan Wojcieleski, she's Polish, by the way. And so what is my son? He's a black polar. Plain as that. That's what he is. And he's a good kid. Thank God he has a little of me in him, but he don't have all of me in him. Thank you, Lord, for not having all of me in him. And this past 26 years has been a struggle trying to forge a relationship with him. Any kind of relationship. It's hard when you try to be a long-distance dad. And we know what the dad, big dads are, especially in Georgia. They lock you up for that stuff down here. Alimony and all that good stuff and not being there. But I didn't have a problem with his mother. His mother kind of respected me in that aspect that she knew I wasn't stable. She knew I wasn't stable when we met, but that shows you how stable she was. But the day he said, you know, in this fellowship, in this journey, you know, I moved here in 1986. Had an aunt who had died over in Meridian, Mississippi. And we had a little convoy that came down from Gary. And I felt again, boy, this is my way out. You know, I'm going to the A. In 86, Atlanta was a lot slower. It wasn't nearly this many folks in Atlanta back in 86. Of course, that shows you, 25 some odd years, the city has changed. Because I remember the Chelex down there at, the Chelex right there at that bank on P Street. I think it was like a million point something. Now that same Chelex say 5 point something. Wow. So in 25 some odd years, over 4 million people have moved here. You know, my friends would say, this is the Mecca. And the first thing they asked me, well, why are you Southern? I mean, why are you Northern want to come down to the dirt south? You know, what's up with that? You know, and I just was honest with them. You know, I love the honey. I love Georgia peaches. You know, easy picking. And there's jobs. You know, there's jobs. So in 86, I got here, and I went here 3 months and ended up working at Lockheed. Lockheed, Georgia Company in Marietta. Now, you talking about somebody who, oh, man, I can walk into Lockheed dressed just like this and walk out the same way with not a piece of grease on me. I didn't have to wear no hard hat, no safety goggles, no steel-toed boots. I thought I was in heaven, man. And I worked there about 2 years, and they had this massive layoff in 88. And I got caught up in it. So here we go again. But the beauty of that was I got some knowledge about the city. I got an opportunity because I worked in the mills. Much as I hated them, I ended up working in it. But that helped me because of my resume. I was a steel worker. I worked in a tubing factory up there at Sheet and King, the Sheet and King Corporation, which basically makes steel. And that helped me with my resume getting this job in Lockheed. And one of my younger sisters, her boyfriend from the Virgin Islands, Danny Baptista. Oh man, it seemed like everybody I knew though, either drank or did drugs. And Danny did both. All the time. How he worked at Lockheed for 10 years I'll never know. But he did, and he helped me get out of there. And we forged a pretty good friendship. And but during that same time when I moved here, and my younger sister Renee, we were very much alike. When I moved here, Renee was on cocaine, something like crazy. You know, I mean, and I didn't know. But I knew something was wrong because she loved to eat like we all love to eat. But when I looked in the refrigerator, all she had was a frozen chicken. I'm like, what's up with that, you know? When are we going to go out to eat, you know? I mean, I know fish on Friday. I know we're supposed to cook a big Sunday dinner on Sunday. None of this was happening. All Renee was doing was coming in after every night, partying like crazy. And we ended up moving off out of Stone Mountain. We moved over here up Buford Highway. And here, again, I'm working at Lockheed. She's working down at CNN Center. But yet, we can't even pay the bills. So I called my parents, and I said, y'all better come get Renee. And they say, mind your own business. Because if you keep acting like that, we're going to come get you. That's not what I expected. But the bottom line was, I knew my sister was on drugs. And as me and Danny, we just owned just as much drugs. We just weren't doing cocaine. We drinking Budweiser and smoking marijuana every day. And I didn't think I was as bad as smoking cocaine. But it is. An addiction is an addiction is an addiction. It's like a drug's a drug's a drug. And eventually she kicked Danny out, so I knew my days were numbered, so I moved right across the street over here. The apartments they used to be called Mark Demeek. And it's strange because she ended up losing an apartment right here on Buford Highway and moved in with me. So he had nowhere to go, so I let her move in with me. Now that it's reversed, you know. Now I'm kind of in control. I can call the shots. And she used to drop me off right here in Napa. She would go smoke cocaine. And that was 24 years ago. My sister had 24 years of recovery right out of her bed. And it's strange how this thing works, but when I got introduced to Napa, I had just come out of all places, Charter Petrie. And Charter Petrie, as most of us know, it's like a resort, man. It's just, to me, it wasn't recovery. It was like you get to eat good, you get to watch TV. I mean, you get your own meds. It was like heaven. But hell, after a month, I think it was like $20,000, you know, that usually you had to have insurance to stay at Charter Petrie. After that first day, they found that if you didn't have insurance, Holland, you know. So after I left Charter, and that was like in 88, going on 89, they recommended Napa. And that was my first meeting here in 1989. It was quite different than it is now, believe me. This guy right here, Stan Parks, he used to be here, Joe Lewis, Don Shears, Dick Hickey, Roland. It was a bunch of old-timers I call heavy hitters, but they were white heavy hitters. They weren't like the black guys we have today. These guys taught recovery, and they meant it. They went with nothing outside of alcoholism. And they called you on it, too. If you come in there talking about crack or anything of that nature, they pulled you outside and had a discussion with you. And it was like, holy man, I got a problem. They said, yeah, but this is about alcoholism. We got other places we can, you know, suggest that you go if you want to talk about your other addictions. So coming in Napa and being in Napa, you know, has really been a struggle for me. You want to be a part of, but also have the street in you, you know. And growing up in the streets and wanting to be hip, slick, and cool is something I always wanted to be. But I also knew that lifestyle consists of drugs, drinking, partying, all-nighters, just doing crazy stuff, trying to be accepted, want to be a part of. So I had to let go of that lifestyle, you know. This lifestyle has become so much more simpler, so much more rewarding. And, by the way, this big book that I'm going to show you is it's my dad's big book. And I hold it very highly because, you know, it's one of the few things that I keep of his, and I keep it with me 24/7. Because I told this story, and Terry Pimbleton, he comes here all the time. I mentioned how much I despise my dad. And as I got older, and all the trials and tribulations I went through, and how they was there for me at every turn, how much I became to love him and respect him. Not just as a father or a man, but as someone who had the same problem I did. So Terry said he didn't pass on the disease of alcoholism to you. When he gave you that book, he said he passed on the solution. And I believe that. You know, the solution's in the book. The solution is in these rooms. The solution is in recovery. And I mentioned my manic depression. And manic depression, boy, when I read this in the doctor's opinion, it just blew me away because I felt a part of this, but I also had other illnesses that I couldn't really address in here. So when I read this, they said, there's the type of man, this is in the doctor's opinion, there's the type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways to drink. He changes his brand or his environment. There's the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depression type. Ha ha! Who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. I like to change that chapter to a whole book. And then there is the type entirely normal in every respect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. And that kind of summed up my story, you know, because I wanted to be a part of it so desperately. But at the same time, I didn't want to address what was making me insane. And when you have a mental disorder, like I've had most of my life since I was a teenager, it was easy for me to say I was an alcoholic and addict. And I'd be damned if I'm going to tell you if I'm bipolar disorder, you know. And I had to see a shrink, and I had to see a therapist, and I had to take medication. Oh, no. What does that got to do with alcoholism? For this alcohol, it has all to do with alcoholism. Because if I don't address one of my illnesses, same with my illness with having ulcerative colitis, I'm going to be unbalanced, pretty much. Because I'm going to substitute one drug for another. And I hate the fact that I have to take medication. I never liked to take medication. So what would I do? I would stop taking the meds after feeling well, get stable, everything's good, normal. Then I would self-medicate with alcohol, which was always my drug of choice. And if you know anything about an engine, and I have a lot of engine blood in me, you know, that's like, you know, that's pouring gas on top of what? Fire. And believe me, I'm a red guy. So you can imagine when I get hot and heated and I'm out of control, oh my God. I scare people, man. I scare people. And that's a frightening thing, especially when you don't even know you're scared. You know, I went in there, this was about 10 years ago. I was on Cascade at the new Applebee's. And I walked in, and I had all this black on. That black leather, coat to the ground, hat. And I had this Michael Vick black jersey on. Now, we know Michael Vick and all what he's been through. But when I took that coat off and I sat at that counter, the place was just jumping. I mean, everybody was laughing, joking, kids, everybody having a good time. When I took that coat off and sat at that bar, the place went deathly quiet. I'm talking, you hear a pin drop. And I'm looking around like, what the hell's going on? And I noticed everybody was looking at me. I didn't order nothing to drink. I said, can I get a lemonade or something? The young lady looked at me and started to... And she was frightened to death. Like, Jesse James is like, I was going to rob the place or something. I didn't know what the hell was going on. So I haven't got out of there. And from that moment on, you know, like I said, that's been over 10 years ago. I noticed something about me, you know. When I'm not stable, people see me. My family have seen it for years and years. They would see it in me before I would see it. You know how you can look at your mom in the eye when you're good, but when you're being bad, that's the last thing you're going to do is look your mother in the eye. You're not going to look your dad in the eye, sisters, brothers, because they know something's wrong. But hell, I don't know. And they don't tell me. They call 911. And DeKalb County tell me. And then a Brady tell me. A Georgia Regional tell me. A Charter Peace or a Ridgeview. And I'm like, damn. And these, DeKalb Addiction Center. DAC. I mean, GMHI. I mean, I think I've been in all the mental institutions here in Georgia. And then that ain't kind of changed, eh? So damn. And these folks get to wondering, what is it, man? Why do you keep coming back? You know? And I can answer it, you know? I can give them a straight, honest answer. Because they don't want to hear you're an alcoholic anymore, or you're a drug addict, or you're manic depressive. So what? You got ulcerative colitis. Yeah, I do. I lost my colon in 2000 at Jackson Diagnostic Center. I literally almost died on the operating table. So I know I'm a miracle today. I know I'm a miracle. I went from 235 pounds down to 100 pounds in less than 3 months. I couldn't eat, couldn't drink. They fed me intravenously. In essence, they almost killed me. Then they turned around and saved my life. So the first card my mother sent me was just that type of card. She said, son, you're a miracle. It's about time you realize it and take it. Don't fight it. Just like this fellowship, you know. You can't fight something that's going to kill you. Because eventually, that's what it's going to do. And for years, that's what I was trying to do. I didn't like me. I didn't like you. I didn't like people around me. I felt guilty. I felt victimized. And here I was, the biggest damn victim of them all. I was the biggest culprit. I created this drama. So what the solution, what the hell am I going to do about it, man? And that's where this program steps in, and it gives me an opportunity to look at me, honestly, with no reservations, no shame, because normally I'd be crying by now. That's how painful my story used to hurt. Because I would tell it to some women, and they start crying. I'm like, what you crying about? You've been through so much. Yeah, right. Yeah, okay. So what you crying about, you know? If you've never been there, it's hard to understand. It's hard to fathom one person's pain and suffering. But when you've been there and you can actually feel their pain and suffering, it does make it a little more easier to deal with that individual. And that's why today I have no shame in saying that I'm Greg Jackson, a recovering alcoholic and addict, also manic depressive, also have an illness called ulcerative colitis. I have no shame in that today, but for a long, long time it was very painful to say that, especially to a group of people. Half of you I don't know. Majority of you I do. I know on the regular. And this fellowship has granted me an opportunity to get to know people for who they are and what they are, and not to be judgmental, and not to be prejudiced. Because believe me, I was one prejudiced ass dude, man. You know, I had a lot of guilt trips. And the guilty party was me. But I had to take it out on you. So I didn't mind robbing you. I didn't mind stealing from you. I didn't mind lying to you, conning you, whatever it took. I was dissatisfied with it. You know, and today, I ain't got to the other part of me. And Debbie already know this little story. My nickname, like when you growing up in the hood, everybody got a nickname, man. Everybody and their mama got a nickname. You know, and they called me Rock Man. Rock Man. Rock Action. Rock Action Jackson. Yeah, that was it. That was me, man. So I had three nicknames. Rock Action Jackson. No one knew me back then. Growing up, no one called me Greg. My own family called me Rock. My mama called me Rocco. My daddy just called me Rock. And then someone just called me Crazy Ass Rock. You know, and they knew it. And basketball had a lot to do with that because from the hood, you shot the rock. If you gambled, you did what? We didn't shoot cracks, we shot rocks. And when I moved to Atlanta, the first thing the person asked me when I said my name was Rock, he said, how many can I get? I was like, what? What are you talking about? I said, you don't know? Then the Miami boys, they sell us molders over there on Cakewood and go to Thomasville, and you know, you had the Jamaican posse, and they got some rocks bigger than them. And I'm like, damn, what the hell is the deal with these rocks? So I never did cry. Thank God. I'd probably be big as this microphone, man. You know. So I did everything. I did everything to their strength. And I'd have did crack the same damn way I drank and smoked marijuana. So I thank God I never experienced that. But I do know the effect of it. I've seen it firsthand. The same way I've seen junkies shoot themselves up in every part of their body, wherever there's a vein, they're going to shoot it. I imagine the same way with alcohol. I could pour it in my ear. If you take my mouth up, I would, you know. Just that shit. I want the effect. I got to feel it. So the bottom line for me today is just to try to live a simple and peaceful life, man. And Tim, he asked me to do this like, what, about 2.5 months ago. And it scared the hell out of me. And I've told my story before. After about 3 years, I had a sponsor called Mark.
Mark here?
There you go, Mark. I asked Mark, I said, there you go. I said, man, can I tell my story? He said, why the hell not? But I said, it's at the Presbyterian Church up here on Battle Creek and Peachtree Road. He said, yeah, why not? And I told my story there. And trust me, I was the only black person in the damn room. Oh, my goodness, what the hell? What is this about? My man set me up. I mean, big time. Don't be folks. Don't ain't gonna know what I'm talking. But it was the most rewarding, most refreshing, most love I felt in a long time, man. Because so many people after that told my story, came to me, and identified with my story. There was a guy about 16. He walked up to me and said, "I've been in prison too." I didn't want to ask him why, but I shook his hand anyway. And there was a little couple that said they were both manic depressive and they've had this illness and it's been, you know, terrorizing their family for years. And they can identify, but the ones that were alcoholics, they really embraced them. They told me, what a great story. So I wasn't really scared when I came into NAB. Every time I'm telling a story at NAB, I've been coming here since 1989. So why am I still sweating? It's not easy when you tell your story. I know that, you know. And then there's some that can't tell a story. And I'm not trying to point anyone out, but I've heard some stories up here where they talk for 20 minutes and that was it. They said, that's all I got. Well, I can stand up here for probably 20 days and tell mine. You know, it's a lot of things I've been left out and I don't want to go into. I am embarrassed of. I am ashamed of. You know, I did a lot of wicked things in my day. And they tell you, you know, when you're running with the devil, damn, when you're looking in the mirror and you find out that you are the devil. And who I'm running with, they're just as devilish as me. And those are the kind of people I associate myself with. But when I come in here, and I think someone said that earlier, the 545, I'm amongst all these saints. Oh, my God. Saints, but ain't number sinners. Ain't that what Donald MacArthur said? He said, we fall down, but we get up. And that's what this fellowship allows us. I don't care how many times you come in. I don't care how many chips you may pick up. You're a one-chip wonder. God bless you. But I think the majority of it, I know Kai, he's a one-chip wonder. You know, I've heard his story, and I've never heard him tell a story. When I first met him, it was over 20 years ago, and he would walk in with his cowboy hat on, all crooked and whatnot. I thought he was like Crocodile Dundee or somebody. I thought he was new as me. I thought he was a new guy. He never said nothing. He just came in, sat down, had this little look on his face. Then he said he had like 10 years of sobriety. And he said how simple he keeps his program is that he don't drink and he go to meetings. I said, damn, that's cool. And I asked him, I said, how do you do that? He said, I don't drink and I go to meetings. And I said, you know, that is it. He said, that's it. And to this day, here it is, 30 years, I think. Am I close? Okay. Don't drink and go to meetings. Rusty Jones finally woke up over there. Yeah. When I saw Rusty Jones, the first person came to my mind was the gambler. Yeah, Kenny Rogers, man. And then he said his damn name was Rusty Jones. I'm like, is this a car dealership or what? But it's just so many people, there's so many relationships that I forged over the years here that, you know, I brought my parents here for my 3-year anniversary. My mom, at least, but two of my sisters. One of my sisters real pissed at me. That one Renee, the one that I used to run, I didn't even invite her. So, you know, she's totally pissed. But I had to bring those that I felt comfortable with. Those that I knew through all these years. And I'm 54 years old. that has been there for me. You know, I mean, been there, literally, figuratively, in pain, in isolation, in all the trials and tribulations. He never gave up on me. They wanted that son, that bread back, not that rock. See, I had to learn how to deal with that. I had to learn. There's a cycle between the two, because they're part of me. We talk about that in this book, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. When I drank his wealth, I became rock. A lot of times, I didn't even need to drink the drug. And rock just would appear. He said, I'll never say it. But this Greg, that my Miss Marion said, she had to come here tonight to hear my story, to hear the sweet Greg. I don't hear that stuff out there, man. My own family don't call me sweet. They call my daddy Sugar Man. But ain't wasn't that sweet about me, man. I was just the opposite. You know, I was hardcore, bitter, and very, very angry. And today I'm not. You know, they say our experience, strength, and hope is just that. My experience has been, I've been a zip down fool. The strength I have is the day that I know I can change from that zip down fool. The hope I have to offer is that the bottom line is that I can do it. Trust me, anybody can come to you. So I don't know how. I'll take that back. I do know how. You start working this program, and then you get your competent sponsor. And it ain't got to be just one. I've heard some guys say, I go to one home group, I have one sponsor. I have a network of brothers and sisters in my sponsorship. They sponsor me, and I think I sponsor them. I don't know who's be sponsoring who. All I know is that we both trying to live a decent life today. We're trying to live a good life today. And it takes an army to fight this damn disease. Even though we don't say we don't fight it anymore, well, why the hell are we here? You know, amongst friends, amongst family, sometimes among total strangers. My sponsor tells me all the time, a stranger is no one but a friend you haven't met yet. And I believe him. I have a great sponsor. He's a homeboy of mine I grew up with. He knows my history. He's got 15 years in the program. He lives a very, very prosperous life. And I don't mean just prosperous because he's financially set, which he is. His kids are growing. His grandkids are growing. And he's happy, man. He has something I want. And he helps me in this endeavor. He helps me every time I call him. Does he return my call every time? No. Like he tells me, he got a life. You see, he got an 87-year-old mama he got to take care of. He got a wife. He got kids, grandkids. He said, man, whatever you're going through, he said, I'll get back to you. And he texts me sometime. And I'll be pissed off at him. But he always come out of this damn book, you know. It's funny, everything he tells me, he said, is what his sponsor has shared with him. And he said everything his sponsor has shared with him, to share with him, to share with him, it all came out of this book. So sometime, Greg had to do what? Pick up? Duh. Like they say, it's a simple program. It's so simple sometimes, it's downright complicated. Because I do believe the class. I do believe that. If I don't drink and go to a meeting, I'm going to be okay. But when I can't make it to a meeting, and I'm thinking about drinking, I pick up this simple book, written by a couple of various, I don't want to say extraordinary guys, because I think they were just like us, you know. They were professional men, but at the same time, they couldn't stop drinking. So they sat down and they got their heads together. And they probably beat each other up. We don't hear the horror stories in there. Can you imagine two drunks trying to talk about getting sober? I would damn near kill you. And I'm sure you probably want to kill me. But the bottom line was they put their egos aside, they put their differences aside, and they came up with this simple program to save people's lives. And I know for a fact this thing has saved my life, man. It has not only saved my life, it has given me a life. You know, I'm so honored and humbled to be up here, you know. Now, I might tear up a little bit now. Believe that, because I'm an emotional guy. And I ain't got no shame. I'm 6'3", 240 pounds, and I cry today. Why do I cry? Because God has cleansed me. My tears are those of purity. It helps cleanse away the wreckage of my past. And I can laugh about it, but I can also cry about it. But I also know how to pray today. These things I knew before I ever got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just was so damn disobedient. I was like the Hebrews out there in 40 years. You know, they wandered for 40 years.
for a place that went 11 miles away. That sound like an alcoholic to me. Not God, you know. So
I love the fact that, you know, God has allowed me to share my experience with Jehovah, to get up here and share my story. And I recommend, highly recommend, as we say, suggestions. Suggestions are cool, but recommend seems a little more, as my friend likes to say, can strike. It's a little more hardcore. You know? They say you can't tell an alcoholic. And you definitely can't tell him much. But sometimes, for this alcoholic, I need to be told what the hell to do. Don't beat around the bush. Make it simple. Go to meetings, don't drink. It's your sponsor. It's your big book. Work the 12 steps for Alcoholics Anonymous. Put the 12 traditions with it. The principles behind it. The 12 concept. And there's three indispensable. You know, it's something that I think as we grow older, they say we're supposed to grow wiser. And I know for a fact, you're only young once in a lifetime. But you can be immature forever. And growing up ain't easy, you know. My sponsor stressed it to me, four simple things, and I'm going to close with it. He said, Greg, you do four things each day, you're going to be just fine, brother. He said, you clean up. That means you wash your ass, put on some decent clothes, you know. You know how your parents say, you can't go to the hospital without no clean drawers on? Wow! I wonder how many times I went to the hospital or jail with dirty drawers on. I don't even want to imagine that. That's another story. Then he say, suit up, you know. He say, suit up. And when I hear the suit up part, I think, and I feel like it's like when I put on the whole armor of the Lord. And I say, I am a Christian. Sorry, that offends you. Call your sponsor. I was raised a Baptist. I believe in my Lord and Savior. He's allowed me to stand here to praise His holy name. And I hear that we're not supposed to do that in this setting. But I'm sorry, if I don't praise Him, if I don't tell you who He is and what He is to me, then I'm denouncing Him in a lot of ways. You call Him higher power what you want. You know, you can call Him whatever you like. I call Him my Lord and Savior. Because He has saved me from me. And allows me to clean up, show up, shut up, and grow up. You know, and I try to do that on a daily basis. Do I do it perfectly? No. And He knows that. That's why I love my Lord. He knows me. He knows every hair on the top of my head. He knows my heart better than He knows my head. And I do believe He's the same Heavenly Father that He was when I was out there drinking, using, acting crazy. Now that I got some stability in my life again, He hasn't changed. There's ain't nothing new in His life under the sun. There's nothing new. I say my life under the sun. His life is eternal. And that's what I want to be today. I want, when I go in front of my Maker, I want Him to look me in the eye and say, job well done, my son. I don't want to trip on that, man. You know, I didn't think I would be able to do that. Today I know I have an opportunity. I'm not ashamed of Him. I know He's not ashamed of me. I love each and every one of you. Thank you for being here for me and allow me to share my story. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing with us, Greg. I've asked Robert to give out the chips. And no, we did not try to coordinate our outfits. That's okay.
Hello, my name is Robert, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Robert.
Good to see everybody tonight. Here at NAVA, Monday night, 8 o'clock, speaker meeting. We have a chip system, as do many other places. Color-coded, white, Serenity chip, Surrender chip. Anybody like to pick up a white chip tonight? Trying to wear it off. After the white chip, we have a silver chip, which marks 30 days. Is there anybody tonight for 30 days? Yeah? Is there anybody else? Nope. We have a red ship for 90 days. No? Red ship? Anybody? Once, twice? Okay. Yellow chip for 6 months? Yellow? Anybody? Nobody wants a hug? All right. We have a green chip for 9 months. Oh, 3 months? 90 days? Anybody for green? Anybody that didn't hear me? Makes me feel better knowing I'm not the only deaf person. Blue chip. 1 year, multiples thereof. You get a pretty blue chip. Yeah.
Humility and truth is amazing. I know we have pockets of wrong, but I look at other groups and the humility and the years of sobriety are amazing, and that's what I take from it. It's amazing.
Is there anybody else tonight who has a birthday? No. All right. Well, usually offer the white chip. That's okay. Usually offer the white chip twice.
Why that?
In case you're too nervous to come and pick it up here in front of everybody, you can pick it up after the meeting. All right. If that's it, then we like this basket and be grateful for the chips.
Okay, the seventh tradition basket was circulated earlier. For those who missed the opportunity to contribute whatever you may afford to support our speaker program at NavaClub.org, you may find two convenient volunteer baskets outside right before you exit on the chair and the table. And thank you for your support. Are there any AA or Nava Club announcements? Thanks, Mark. Anyone else? Hey, Tim, where was that?
Next week.
Who's telling their story? I can't see it. Let's see. Monday, April 25th, Sam M. will be telling a story, and Monday, May 2nd, Tim R. So please join us for that. I would like to remind everyone that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, of reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who would please join us, for the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you.